tension from the banal reality of the truth. It was nothing but another cold, ambitious little man playing for power. No different from Lovelace, or Duval, or, and at this thought Nathaniel felt a chill upon his spine, from Nathaniel's own musings that very evening, as he sat in the car and dreamed of seizing the staff and putting an end to the war. Oh yes, he'd told himself it was for the right reasons, to help the commoners and save the empire, but where did such idealism end? With bodies like Kitty's lying on the floor. How naked and obvious Nathaniel's ambition must have been. Makepeace had seen it. Farrer, too. Muslutchins had understood it and walked away. No wonder Kitty had treated him with such disdain. As he had watched over her body in the Hall of Statues, he had come to share her contempt. But then she had woken, and with his relief came new determination. The conspirators were busy. Back and forth across the room they scampered, bringing out the paraphernalia of summoning. Candles, bowls, herbs, and flowers. In the centre of the hall the heavy rugs had been pulled clear and unceremoniously dumped to one side. Several pentacles were revealed beneath, beautifully inlaid in mother-of-pearl and lapis-lazuli. Makepeace stood within one, stripped down to his shirt-tails, pointing, pouting, issuing shrill commands. Kitty Jones still crouched as before. Nathaniel strolled forward, bent at her side, and spoke softly. "Kitty, get up." He extended his bound hands. "Come on. That's it. Sit over here." He pushed aside a heavy chair of redwood and helped lower her down. "Rest there. Are you all right?" "Yes." "Then wait. I'll get you out of this." "How's that exactly?" "Trust me." He leaned against the table, appraising the situation. By the door, the mercenary stood, arms folded, gazing implacably toward them. No possibility of escape there. The conspirators themselves were feeble. It was easy to see now why Makepeace had recruited them. He had chosen the weak, the unpreferred, those eaten away with jealousy and malice, who would seize the opportunity but never be a threat to him. The playwright was a different matter, a formidable magician. Without his demons, Nathaniel was helpless. Makepeace. He cursed again his own stupidity. For years he had suspected the presence of a traitor high in government, someone connected to both the Lovelace and the Duval plots. Four magicians had been needed to summon the great demon Ramuthra back at Headlam Hall. The fourth had never been seen, save for a fleeting glimpse in an open-topped car, a flash of goggles, a red beard. Gone. Makepeace in disguise? Easy to imagine now. During the Golem affair, Nathaniel had been surprised how easily the playwright had discovered the location of the fugitive Kitty. That must have been Hopkins, then. Makepeace's contact with the Resistance. Nathaniel ground his teeth. How swiftly Makepeace had won him over. Used him as an ally, played him for a fool. Well, the matter wasn't over yet. Stony-faced, Nathaniel watched Mr. Hopkins hurrying past to obey his leader's orders. So this was the mysterious scholar he had sought so long. A demon's power coursed through the villain's body, of that there was no doubt. But the meek little man would hardly be a match for Cormac Codron, Ascobol, and the others, if Nathaniel could only bring them to his side. Yet while Hopkins worked his mischief here, the incompetent djinn were a mile away, waiting vainly for him at the Ambassador Hotel. Nathaniel's brows knotted with frustration. He fidgeted with the cords that bound his hands. All he could do was wait until Makepeace freed him and let him step within a pentacle. Then he could act. In an instant his servants would be summoned and the traitors brought to account.
"My friends, I am ready. Come, Mandrake. Miss Jones. You must join the audience."
Makepeace was standing in the nearest circle, shirt sleeves rolled up, collar undone. He had adopted a heroic pose, hands on hips, pelvis thrust forward, legs wide enough to straddle a horse. The conspirators congregated at a respectful distance. Even the mercenary showed sufficient interest to stalk a little closer. Together, Nathaniel and Kitty approached the pentacle.
"The time has come," Makepeace cried. the moment toward which I have worked for so many years. Only the thrill of anticipation, my friends, keeps me from bursting with my pent emotions."
With a dynamic flourish, he removed a lacy handkerchief from a pocket and dabbed at his eyes.
"How much sweat, how many tears have I shed to get so far?" he cried. "Who can tell? How much blood?"
"Secretions aside," Rufus Lime interjected sourly, "hadn't you better get on with it? Some of those candles are burning low."
Makepeace glared at him, but returned his hanky to his pocket. "Very well, my friends. Following the success of Hopkins here and subduing a demon of moderate power—"
Hopkins gave a little smile which might have meant anything.
"I have decided to apply my more considerable ability to the taming of a greater entity."
He paused.
"This very evening Hopkins located in the London Library a volume listing the names of spirits from ancient Persia. I have decided to make use of a name he found there. My friends, here and now, before your very eyes, I shall summon into myself the greater demon known as Nauda."
Nathaniel uttered a small exclamation. "Nauda? The man was mad."
"Makepeace," he said, "surely you're joking. This procedure is risky enough without trying something so powerful."
The playwright pursed his lips fretfully. "I'm not joking, John. Just ambitious. Mr. Hopkins has assured me that control is simplicity itself, and I am very strong-willed. I hope you don't mean to imply that I'm not up to this."
"Oh, no," Nathaniel said hastily. "Not at all."
He leaned close to Kitty.
"Man's a fool," he whispered. "Nauda is a terrible entity, one of the most fearsome recorded. It left Persepolis in ruins."
Kitty leaned over, whispered back.
"I know. Destroyed Darius's own army." "Yes,"
Nathaniel nodded. Then he blinked.
"What? How did you know?"
"John," Makepeace's voice was tetchy, "enough canoodling. I need silence now. Hopkins, if you see anything go amiss, reverse the process. Use Asprey's overrule. Right. Quiet all."
Quentin Makepeace closed his eyes, bent his head toward his chest. He flourished his arms and flexed his fingers. He breathed deeply. Then he lifted his chin, opened his eyes, and began to declaim the incantation in a loud, clear voice. Nathaniel listened hard. As before, it was a simple enough Latin summons, but the strength of the oncoming spirit meant that it had to be reinforced with multiple wordlocks and tortuous subclauses doubling back on themselves to shore up the binding. He had to admit that Makepeace spoke it well. Minutes passed. His larynx never faltered. He ignored the perspiration running down his face. There was a hush in the chamber. Nathaniel, Kitty, the conspirators, all watched transfixed. Most avid of all was Mr. Hopkins. He was leaning forward with his mouth open. He had a slightly hungry look. On the seventh minute, the room grew cold. Not slowly, but in an instant, as if a switch had suddenly been pressed. Everyone began to shiver. On the eighth minute came the sweetest of fragrances, that of meadow flax and celandine. On the ninth minute, Nathaniel detected something in the pentacle with Makepeace. It was there on the third plane, something hazy, fluctuating, sucking in the light. A dark horned mass, now tall, now broad, with arms that spread out and pressed against the pentacle. Nathaniel looked down. He thought he saw the inlaid boundaries of the circle bulge out a little in the floor. The features of the newcomer could not be seen. It towered over Makepeace, who spoke on, quite oblivious, to his new companion. Makepeace came to the climax of his command, the moment when he bound the demon inside himself. With a cry he spoke the final words. The dark figure vanished, like blinking. Makepeace stopped. He was quite still. His eyes looked out beyond his audience, as if at something far away. Everyone watched, frozen to the spot. Makepeace did nothing. His face was blank.
"Hopkins," Rufus Lime said hoarsely. "Dismiss it, quick."
With a great cry, Makepeace sprang into life.
It was quite without warning. Nathaniel cried out. Everyone jumped. Even the mercenary stepped back.
Success!
Makepeace leapt from the circle. He clapped his hands, capered, hopped, skipped, and twirled.
Success! Such triumph! I cannot begin to tell you!
The conspirators inched closer. Jenkins peered out above his glasses.
Quentin, is it true? How does it feel?
Yes, Nauda is here. I feel it within. Ah, for a moment or two, my friends, there was a struggle, I admit it. The effect was disconcerting, but I commanded it most strictly, with all my power, and I felt that demon shrink back and obey. It is subservient within me. It knows its master. What is it like? Hard to describe. It is not painful, exactly. I sense it like a hard, hot coal within my head. But when it obeyed, I felt such a surge of energy. Oh, it cannot be imagined!
With this, the conspirators erupted into raucous celebration. They squealed and jumped for joy.
"The demon's power, Quentin!" Lime shouted. "Use it!"
"Not yet, my friends."
Makepeace held up his hands for calm. The room fell silent.
"I could destroy this room," he said. "Turn all of it to powder if I chose. But there shall be time enough for fun once you have followed me. Go to your pentacles. Summon your demons. Then we shall set about our destiny. We shall seize the staff of Gladstone and take a stroll through London. I believe some commoners are busy demonstrating. Our first task will be to put them in their place."
Like eager children, the conspirators scampered to their circles. Nathaniel grasped Kitty by the arm, drew her to one side.
"In a moment," he hissed, "I shall be called upon to join this madness. I will pretend to do so. Do not be alarmed. At the last minute I shall use the pentacle to summon a troop of the strongest djinn. With luck they will destroy Makepeace and those other fools. At the very least, we shall have the opportunity to escape."
He paused triumphantly. "You don't seem overly impressed." Kitty's eyes were tired, red-rimmed. Had she been crying? He hadn't noticed. She shrugged. "Well, I hope you're right." Nathaniel swallowed his irritation. In truth, he was nervous too.
"You'll see."
Across the hall, the summonings began. Rufus Lime, eyes tight shut, fish mouth open, intoning his words in a muttered croak. Clive Jenkins, glasses removed from his little nose and held anxiously between his hands as he spoke in a rapid monotone. The others, whose names Nathaniel could not remember, stood in solitary postures, hunched, erect, shaking, stammering out their incantations, making the necessary gestures. Hopkins and Makepeace walked approvingly among them.
"John!"
That was Makepeace. With a trill of delight he bounded over.
"Ah, such energy! I could leap to the stars!"
His face went serious.
"Not holding back on us, are you, boy? Why aren't you in a circle?"
Nathaniel raised his hands.
"Perhaps if I was untied?"
"Ah, yes! How discourteous of me! There!"
A snap of the fingers, the cords burst into lilac flames. Nathaniel shook himself free.
"There is an empty pentacle in that corner, John," Makepeace said. "What demon have you chosen for yourself?"
Nathaniel chose two at random.
"I was debating between two djinn from Ethiopian texts, Zosa and Kaloum."
"An interesting, if modest, choice. I suggest Kaloum. Well, off you go."
Nathaniel nodded. He took a quick sidelong glance at Kitty, who was watching him intently, then strode toward the nearest vacant pentacle. He hadn't much time. Through the corner of his eye he saw strange, contorted shadows flittering above Jenkins and Lime. Heaven knew what the idiots had summoned, but with luck it would take a while for them to control their internal slaves. Before that happened, Cormac Codron and Hodge would make short work of them. He stepped inside his circle, cleared his throat, and looked around. Makepeace was watching him intently. Doubtless he was suspicious. Nathaniel grinned bleakly to himself. Well, those suspicions were about to be confirmed in the most dramatic possible way. A final moment of preparation. He would need to work swiftly when his djinn arrived, give precise and urgent orders. Then Nathaniel acted. He made an ornate gesture, cried out the names of his 5 strong demons, and pointed at the neighbouring circle. He steeled himself for the explosions, the smoke and hellfire, the sudden appearance of straining, hideous forms. With a miserable squelch, something small and insubstantial struck the centre of the circle, spattering outward like a fruit dropped from on high. It had no discernible shape, but gave off a strong smell of fish. A bulge rose in its centre. A small voice sounded, "Saved!" The bulge rotated, appeared to notice Mr. Hopkins.
"No."
Nathaniel gazed at it wordlessly. Quentin Makepeace had seen it also. He stepped close, inspected it.
"Hop-culiar. It seems to be some kind of uncooked meal, with added sentience. What do you think, Hopkins?"
Mr. Hopkins approached. His eyes glittered as they glanced at Nathaniel. "Nothing so innocent, I'm afraid, sir. It is the remains of a pernicious djinnie, which earlier this evening attempted my capture. Several other demons who accompanied him I have already slain. I fear that Master Mandrake was hoping to catch us unawares."
"Is that so?"
Quentin Makepeace straightened sadly.
"Oh, dear. That rather changes things. I always had such high hopes for you, John. I really thought we might work well together. Still, never mind. I have Hopkins and my 5 loyal friends to count on."
He glanced round at the conspirators, who, having finished their summonings, stood quietly in their circles.
"That is enough. Our first pleasure will be to watch you and your creature die."
"Hum!"
He put his hand to his mouth.
"Excuse me, I fear I have indigestion. Now then."
Another gulp, a gasp. His eyes bulged.
"This is most curious. I—"
His tongue protruded. His limbs shook, his knees sagged. He seemed about to fall. Nathaniel stepped back in shock. Makepeace's body gave a sudden wriggle. It writhed, somewhat like a snake, as if all his bones were newly fluid. Then it steadied, stiffened. The playwright seemed to rally. For the briefest of instants, a panicked look erupted in the eyes. The tongue managed to gabble out the words,
"It is—"
A furious writhing drowned out the rest. Makepeace moved like a puppet on twisted strings. The head jerked up. The eyes were staring, lifeless. And the mouth laughed. Standing all around him in their circles, Lime, Jenkins, and the rest of the conspirators joined in the laughter. Their bodies seemed to ape their leaders. They twitched and wriggled, too. Nathaniel stood transfixed as the noise erupted around him. It was not kind or pleasant laughter, nor was it particularly malicious, greedy, triumphant, or cruel. It would have been less distressing if it had been. Instead, the sound was hollow, discordant, and utterly alien. It contained no recognizable human emotion. In fact, it wasn't human at all. Chapter 24. Bartimaeus. It was the soup that saved me. Fish soup it was, thick and creamy, filling the space of the silver tureen. At first, when I was pressed hard up against the silver walls, my essence dissolved rapidly away. But unexpectedly, things got better. Almost as soon as Fakwal left me, I lapsed into silver-induced unconsciousness, and that meant my crow eyes fell apart. I subsided into an oily, fluid mass, not unlike dishwater, which floated within the soup, insulated from the silver by the liquid all around. I wouldn't say I was well off, exactly, but my essence was now disintegrating a good deal slower than Fakwal would have expected. Flickers of awareness came and went. One moment I thought I was far away in Egypt, talking with Ptolemy for the last time. The next I was watching fragments of cod and halibut drift by. Occasionally, Fakwal's declaration echoed in my mind. "From tonight we take revenge." Sounded ominous for somebody. Well, they were welcome to it. I was tired. I'd had enough. I was glad to be somewhere quiet, dying on my own. And then, all of a sudden, the soup was gone, the freezing taint of silver likewise. I was freed from the tureen. Good news, unquestionably. Trouble was, I was no longer alone. My master? Yes, that was predictable. I could just about cope with him. But then, when I rotated gloopily to check out the scene, who did I see next? Let's just say that when your arch-enemies trapped you in a place of certain death, and you survived heroically against all the odds, the last thing you want to see, when you escape at last, is that same arch-enemy glaring down at you with an expression of annoyed distaste. Even a different arch-enemy would have been marginally better. Not only that, you're weak, look like a jellyfish, and smell of clam chowder. In such circumstances, the wind kind of goes out of your sense of triumph. But that wasn't the half of it. As well as Mandrake and Fakwal, there were others in that room, and I arrived just in time to see exactly what they were. 5 gates to the other place were open, and my essence trembled with the onrush of activity. Humans stood in 5 pentacles. On the first plane they seemed to stand alone. On the second and third they were accompanied by billowing shadows of uncertain proportions. On the higher planes, these shadows resolved themselves into hideous, writhing masses, in which numerous tentacles, limbs, eyes, spines, and prongs kept uncomfortable proximity. As I watched, each mass compressed itself down and merged inside the waiting human. Soon even the most awkward leg or feeler was withdrawn from sight. For the first few seconds, the humans seemed to be in charge. They blinked, stirred, scratched their heads, and, in the case of my old chum Jenkins, placed his glasses carefully on his nose. Only the fact that their auras now glowed with extraordinary strength indicated that anything odd had happened. I wasn't fooled, of course. From what I'd seen of Fakwal and his treatment of Mr. Hopkins, I didn't think the humans would be on top for long. And sure enough, they weren't. A vibration in the planes behind me. I swiveled like an amoeba on a turntable, and saw another human, a short, round man, wearing an excessively frilly shirt. And this is when I got really worried. His aura was huge. It radiated out like a sunburst, vibrating with otherworldly colours and a malevolent vitality. I didn't need to be told that something had already taken residence in him. He spoke. I wasn't listening. All of a sudden, his aura pulsed, just once, as if a door to a furnace deep inside him had been opened wide, and the short, round man lost his mind. For all Fakwal's protestations to the contrary, the notion of bonding with a human is a pretty obnoxious one. For one thing, you don't know where it's been. For another, mixing your essence with horrid, heavy, earthy flesh is an aesthetic no-no. It makes you queasy just thinking about it. And then there's the small matter of control, of learning how to operate the human body. Fakwal had had some practice at this with Hopkins, but the newcomers had not. As one, the 6 magicians, the short round man, and the others in the circles, laughed, twitched, shook, stumbled, jerked their arms every which way, and fell over. I looked up at Fakwal. Ooh, scary. The revenge of the djinn begins. He scowled, bent to assist his leader, and was distracted by a movement near the door. It was another old friend, the mercenary. His face, which normally showed all the weakness and soft emotion of a granite slab, was wide-eyed with shock. Perhaps it was the sight of the magicians lying on their backs like upturned woodlice, arms and legs wriggling helplessly. Perhaps it was the realization that he was unlikely to get a fee. Whichever it was, he decided to depart. He moved to the door. Fakwal sprang through the air. He landed by the mercenary. A single shrug of the spindly arms, the mercenary was flung across the room to land heavily against a statue. He struggled to his feet and drew a knife. Fakwal was on him in a flash. There was a blur of movement, the sound of multiple blows being struck. It sounded like a brawl in a saucepan factory. The scimitar spun across the floor. The mercenary slumped against the flagstones, gasping for breath. Fakwal straightened, adjusting Mr. Hopkins' tie, and strode back to the centre of the room. I'd watched with grudging approval. Nice one. I've been trying to do that for years. Fakwal shrugged. The secret is to avoid magic, Bartimaeus. The fellow's resilience is excessive. It almost seems to feed off our energies. It helps to be encased in a mortal body, and don't think you're going anywhere either. I'll tend to you shortly." He trotted after the body of the short round man, which was now rolling across the floor, uttering odd barks and cries. Maybe it was a vanity thing, but I was a bit tired of remaining as a pool of glop. With a tremendous effort, I drew myself up into a pyramid of slime. Was that any better? No. But I was too far gone to try anything sophisticated. The slime looked about for Mandrake. If things were bad for me, they weren't too sunny for him either. To my astonishment, I saw him standing at a table with Kitty Jones. It was the Kitty Jones bit that was astonishing, not the table, though it was very nicely polished. Now that took me by surprise. I couldn't fit her into the equation at all. What was more, Mandrake was busily trying to untie some cords binding her hands. Weird. If anything, it was odder than the Fackwell-Hopkins combo thing. Neither looked in very good nick, but they were talking avidly, peering toward the door. The mercenary's misadventure had not been lost on them. They made no hasty move. Slowly, as slime will, I set off across the floor toward them. But I hadn't gone far when the whole floor shook, flagstones cracked, and statues toppled against the wall. It was as if an earthquake had struck, or a mother rock had landed overhead. In fact, the culprit was the short, round man who lay still upon the ground. He had managed to roll onto his side, but was now attempting to rise using his legs alone, an effort that made him rotate slowly in a clockwise direction. Whatever was inside him was growing frustrated. A hand slapped petulantly against the stones. With every slap, it shook the room. Fackwell had hastened over and was seeking to haul him upright. "Press the feet flat against the ground, Lord Nauda. There, let me take your weight. That's it. Steady yourself. Now you can rise. Success! We are vertical." Nauda? The pyramid of slime tilted its apex. Had it heard correctly? Surely not. Surely not even the stupidest magician would have been so vain, so foolhardy, so plain ignorant, as to invite a being like Nauda within them. Surely everyone knew his track record. It seemed not. Oh, right. Well, it's like this. As I may have mentioned once or twice, there are five basic levels of spirit. Imps, reprehensible. Foliates, negligible. Djinn, a fascinating class, with one or two absolute gems. Afrits, overrated. And Marids, dreadfully full of themselves. Above these levels exist more powerful entities, shadowy by nature, who are only occasionally summoned or even defined. Nauda was one such, and his rare appearances on Earth left a trail of blood and misery. Only the most unpleasant regimes employed him. The Assyrians, during the Battle of Nineveh, when Nauda devoured 1,000 Medes. Timur the Cruel, at the sack of Delhi, during which Nauda stacked the heads of prisoners to a height of 50 feet. The Aztecs, a regular engagement for Nauda, this. In the end, he discovered an ambiguity in Montezuma's summons. As a reward, Nauda ravaged Tenochtitlan and left it defenceless against the Spanish. He was a formidable customer, in other words, hungry and not sympathetically inclined. Fackwell was ushering the twitching body forward like an invalid, encouraging it with soothing words. "Just a little farther, Lord Nauda. A chair awaits. Try moving the feet instead of the hands. That's it. You are doing splendidly." From the man's sagging mouth came a great voice.
"Who speaks?"
"It is I, Fackwell."
"Ah, Fackwell," the great voice cried. "You did not lie. It is exactly as you said. What joy I feel. No pain, no compulsion. I smell the human world and all the juicy bodies waiting. Oh, but my coordination vexes me. This you did not prepare me for."
"It takes a little time," Fackwell crooned. "You will soon acclimatize."
"So many peculiar muscles. I cannot make out their use. Joints that swivel so far and no more.
tendons running every which way, the dull sloshing of the blood. How strange for it to be my own! I wish to tear the flesh apart and drink it down.
I would curb that impulse, sir, Fakwal said crisply. You might find it inexpedient. There will be plenty of other flesh to enjoy, fear not. Now, here, sit on this throne. Rest a while.
He stood back. The short, round body of Makepeace sank upon the golden chair. Its head lolled sideways, its limbs twitched. On the other side of the table, Kitty and Mandrake shrank away.
"Where are my troops, dear Fakwal?" the great voice said. "Where is my army that you promised?"
Fakwal cleared his throat.
"Right in this room, sir. They, like you, are just coming to terms with their new status."
He looked over his shoulder. Of the five magicians, three were still lying on the floor. One was sitting up and grinning inanely, while the fifth had actually risen and was stumbling randomly about the hall, with arms rotating like a windmill and feet tripping on the rugs.
"Looking good," I said. "One day they may even manage to conquer this room."
Fakwal turned purposefully.
"Ah, yes, I'd forgotten about you."
Eyes rotated blindly in the limp, round head.
"To whom do you speak, Fakwal?"
"A jinni. Pay no attention. He will not be with us long."
"What jinni is this? Is he a supporter of our plan?"
"It is Bartimaeus, a skeptic."
One arm rose, made a spasmodic movement that was probably meant to beckon. The great voice boomed.
"Come here, jinni."
The pyramid of slime hesitated, but there was no help for it. I did not have the power to resist or flee. With all the verve of a wounded slug, I squelched my way toward the golden chair, leaving an unpleasant trail behind. I bowed as best I could.
"It is an honour to meet a spirit of such strength and renown," I said. "I am but a wisp upon the wind. Nevertheless, my power is yours."
Note the absence of any jokes, sneers, or satirical content in these sentences. Despite Nauda's current indisposition, I didn't doubt that he could atomize me with a single glance. Best to be polite, I felt. The limp head gave a jerk. With a wild swivel, the eyes discerned me.
"Greater or less, we are all children of the other place. May your essence prosper."
Fakwal stepped forward.
"Well, I wouldn't go too far," he said. "Bartimaeus is as fickle as a moonbeam, and as flighty as a colt, and sarky with it. I was about to—"
The Great Spirit waved a plump little hand in what was probably intended to be a mild gesture. It swung out wildly and cracked the table-top in two.
"Be quiet, Fakwal. After centuries of slavery, all our personalities distort a little."
"I don't know," Fakwal said doubtfully. "He's pretty distorted."
"Even so, we do not fight among ourselves."
The pyramid of slime nodded eagerly. "That's right. Hear that, Fakwal? Listen and learn."
"Especially," the great voice continued, "when the jinni is as pitiable as this. Look at him. A baby's burp could disperse his essence. You have been poorly treated, Bartimaeus. Together we shall locate your oppressor and devour his flesh."
I glanced surreptitiously at my master, who was steadily backing away toward the door, shepherding Kitty with him. His treatment of her seemed, well, let's put it this way, it was hard to tell exactly how it was self-serving. No doubt there were ulterior motives aplenty, if you only knew where to look for them.
"That's a generous offer, Lord Nauda."
Fakwal looked a little peeved.
"The problem," he said, "is that Bartimaeus does not approve of our scheme. He has already referred to my occupation of this vessel,"
he pointed to Hopkins' chest and paused dramatically,
"as icky." "Well, look at you," I snapped. "Trapped inside a horrid—"
I controlled myself, conscious again of Nauda's fearsome aura. "To be honest, Lord Nauda, I am not sure exactly what your scheme is. Fakwal has not explained fully."
"That is easily remedied, little Jinni."
Nauda seemed aware that his jaw muscles were somehow associated with speaking. As he spoke, the mouth opened and closed at random, sometimes wide, sometimes not. In any case, it was entirely out of sync with his words.
"For centuries we have suffered pain at human hands. Now it is our turn to impose that pain on them. Thanks to Fakwal, and to the foolish magician whose body I now wear, our chance has come. We have entered the world on our own terms, and it is for us to decide what to do with it."
His teeth clacked together twice in a hungry sort of way. This spasm looked quite intentional. "But with all due respect," I ventured, "there are only 7 of you, and the hard part has already been done, Bartimaeus." Fakwal smoothed down his coat. "By me. It has taken years to lure Makepeace to his doom. His ambition was always unwieldy, but it wasn't until the appearance of Honorius in Gladstone's bones that I saw how best to use it. Makepeace's weakness was his vainglorious desire for innovation, for the reckless creative act. After Honorius, he and Hopkins became interested in summoning a spirit into a living body. By subtle insinuations, I encouraged them. In due course, Hopkins volunteered for the experiment, and I was the genie summoned. After that, things were easier. I destroyed Hopkins's mind, but concealed this from Makepeace. Now he has also sacrificed himself and several of his friends."
"There are 7 of us now," Nauda said, "but we can soon get reinforcements. All we need are more human vessels."
"And thanks to Makepeace, we have plenty," Fakwal added. The great entity seemed surprised.
"How so?"
"The entire government lies in a nearby chamber, gagged and bound and ready. You have devoured the magician's memory, Lord Nauda. You would not recall." Nauda gave a wild laugh that knocked over a nearby chair.
"True. There is no point sharing these brains. So, all is well. Our essences are protected. We have no bonds. Soon we shall roam in hundreds about the world and feed upon its people."
Well, I suppose I didn't think it was going to be simple tourism. I was watching Mandrake and Kitty. They were almost at the door. "One question," I said. "When all the killing's done, how will you get back?"
"Back?"
Nauda said. Fakwal echoed him.
"What do you mean, back?"
"Well..." The Pyramid of Slime attempted a shrug, with scant success. "Back to the other place, when you had enough of it here."
"That is not part of the plan, little Jinni."
Nauda's head rotated toward me in a sudden rush.
"The world is big. It is varied. It is ours now."
"But
our hatred has grown so long, it cannot be healed even in the other place. Think of your own experiences. For you, too, it must be so."
A sudden outcry. Nauda jerked confusedly in his chair, splitting the back panel down its center.
"What disturbance is this?"
Fakwal grinned. "Bartimaeus's master, I believe." Shouts, screams. Sure enough, with the incompetence that was his trademark, Mandrake hadn't reached the door. Instead, he and Kitty had been apprehended by the body of Jenkins, which was beginning to move with some coordination. Evidently the spirit inside it was a fast learner. Nauda's voice held interest.
"Bring him here."
It took a while. Jenkins's legs were not yet bending at the knees. But finally 2 disheveled humans stood before the golden chair, Jenkins's hands around their necks. Both Mandrake and Kitty looked haggard and defeated. Their shoulders slumped, their clothes were ripped. Kitty's coat had been burned right through. Unnoticed, the pyramid of slime gave a small, short sigh. Nauda experimented with a ghastly, half-baked smile. He twitched and wriggled excitedly where he sat.
Meat! I smell it! What a blissful flavor!
A light of defiance glimmered in Mandrake's eyes.
Bartimaeus, he croaked, I am still your master. I order you to help us now!
Fakwal and Nauda laughed heartily at this. I did not. That time is past, I said. You would do well to keep silent.
I order you to—
A deep feminine voice emerged from Jenkins's mouth.
Is that you, Bartimaeus?
The slime gave a start. Narian! Haven't seen you since Constantinople.
Listen to me! I order—
What's with the slime, Bartimaeus? You're looking peaky.
Yeah. Been better. How about you, though? Ginger hair, glasses, just two legs. Bit of a come-down, isn't it? This was true. Narian's normal form involved an inky blue-black torso, three piercing eyes placed at random intervals, and a multitude of spider-like limbs. Okay, that guy's was an acquired taste, but it was a lot more dignified than Jenkins.
I order you to...
Mandrake's head dropped. He said no more.
It's worth it, Bartimaeus, Narian said. You can't imagine what it's like. The body is dreary, but it gives such freedom. Will you join us?
Yes, Nauda's great voice put in. Join us! We shall find you an appropriate magician. We will force him to summon you forthwith.
The slime drew itself as tall as it could. My thanks to you both. The offer is courteous and kind, but I fear I must decline. I have had enough of this world and everything in it. My essence hurts me. My only wish is to return to the peace of the other place as fast as I can. Nauda seemed a little put out.
This is an odd decision.
Fakwal spoke eagerly.
It is as I said. Bartimaeus is both fickle and perverse. He should be destroyed with a spasm.
A great growl came from Makepeace's throat. The air quivered with heat haze. The clothes on Fakwal's body crackled into flame. Nauda sucked the air back in. The flames went out. Makepeace's eyes glittered. Somewhere deep inside those eyes I glimpsed the fearful energies of the other place, swirling, swirling. I couldn't help but wonder how long the mortal body would survive the strain of such an inhabitant.
"Beware, Fakwal," the great voice said, "lest your good advice becomes officious. The Jinni is free to go."
The slime bowed. My gratitude is undying, Lord Nauda. If it pleases you to hear me further, I have one last request to make.
On this triumphant day, Nauda said, when my earthly reign begins, I shall grant the wishes of even the weakest, most insignificant of my fellow spirits. And that's you, without a doubt. I shall permit your request, if it lies within my power. Speak on.
The slime bowed lower still. Spare the lives of these two humans, Lord Nauda. The world, as you say, is big. There are many others to devour. Spare these. That got a bit of a reaction. Fakwal gave a snort of disgust. Narian tutted with surprise. As for Nauda, he clashed his teeth together with such force that several cherubs fell off his chair. His eye flashed fire, his fingers gouged the tabletop like butter. I'd say he wasn't overpleased.
"I have given my word, Jinni, and I cannot break it," the great voice said. "But this is ill done. I need some ballast in my belly. I was looking forward to these two, particularly the girl." The boy looked sour and sinewy. I believe his flesh would taste like candle wax, but she is edible beyond doubt, and you would have me spare them. It seems that Fakwal was right. You are perverse.
That was pretty rich, coming from someone who had purposefully trapped himself within the human world, but I didn't argue. I just bowed lower.
Cha!
Nauda was working himself into a strop. With sudden rough coordination, Makepeace's body half rose from his seat.
To have a bond with a human! Ah, you are a corruption. A traitor! I itch to destroy you, but no, I cannot break my promise. Go from here! Be gone from my sight!
I did not show my anger. We do have a bond of sorts, I said quietly, but for the present there are limits to it, which is why I take my leave. The pyramid of slime rotated to face Mandrake, who had been listening white-faced. Dismiss me. It took him several seconds to respond, and only then when Kitty nudged him sharply. When he spoke, he stumbled three times and had to begin again. His voice never rose above a whisper. He did not look in my direction. By contrast, as I rose, flickered, faded, vanished, Kitty never took her eyes off me. My last sight was of them cowering together, two hunched and fragile forms, alone among the djinn. What did I feel? Nothing. I'd done what I could. Nauda's word was his bond. He would spare their lives. Beyond that, it wasn't my business what happened to them. I was getting out, and about time, too. I was lucky to escape with my life. Yes, I'd done what I could. I didn't need to think about it any more. I was free. Free. Look, even at full strength, I'd still have been a speck of insignificance compared to Nauda. What else could I have done? Chapter 25. Kitty. For Kitty, the moments following Bartimaeus's departure were the bleakest and most terrible of all. The last fragment of hope departed, and with it the focus of her captors immediately changed. Hopkins's head turned. In the golden chair the glassy eyes of Makepeace rolled around to stare at her. She felt the ferocity of the demon's gazes, of the cold intelligences hidden behind the waxy faces. She knew what it was to be a lump of meat upon a butcher's slab. The great demon seemed to be gaining control of his human body. Its twitches and shaking had diminished. It sprawled quietly across the chair. Elsewhere in the room, by a similar gradual process, the bodies of the conspirators had risen to their feet, and in a spirit of experimentation were hobbling about the room in little jerks and scampers. Their arms swung, they jumped, crouched, spun on the spot. Their mouths were open. The room was full of the gabble of languages, of triumphant laughter and animal cries. Kitty shuddered. It was a parody, both of everything that was human, and of the dignity she had previously observed in spirits, even the most grotesque. At her back, the demon in Jenkins's body spoke. She did not understand the words. Hopkins nodded, replied, turned to the great demon sitting in the chair. A long conversation ensued. Kitty and Mandrake stood dead still, waiting. Then Hopkins's body moved. The suddenness made Kitty jolt with fear. It turned to them and beckoned. With stiff movements and rigid limbs, they followed it across the hall, among the gambling demons, past the bearded man crouching silently in a corner, and out into the corridor. They took the passage to the left, around numerous twists and turns, above a broad stone staircase leading underground, into an area of many doors. Kitty thought to hear moaning coming from behind the first they passed. The demon continued on. In due course he halted, flung open a door, and gestured for them to enter. It was an empty, windowless room, lit by a single electric light. The demon's voice was harsh. "Thanks to Lord Nauda's unbreakable oath, we are obliged to be merciful. You," it indicated Kitty, "are not a magician, so you shall become an ordinary servant. However, you," this to Mandrake, "are due a greater honour. You shall become a host to one of our number before dawn. Do not look so glum. Think of all the spirits you have enslaved. This judgment upon you has a pleasant symmetry. Until then, you shall remain here. It is not seemly for you to observe us in our current state." The door closed. A key turned. Footsteps receded. Kitty could feel her body shaking with suppressed shock and fear. She bit her lip, forced the feeling down. No good, they hadn't time for that. She looked at Mandrake, and to her surprise saw flecks of tears in the corners of his eyes. Perhaps, like her, he was almost overwhelmed.
He was speaking quietly, as if to himself. Demons have entered the world. Without restraint. It is a catastrophe. No, they hadn't time for that. A catastrophe, she said. Funny. The way I see it, things are looking up. How can you say the demons plan to use me as a slave? Not good, true. But half an hour ago, your friend the Fat Magician was going to have me killed. I look on that as a marked improvement. John Mandrake blew out his cheeks. Makepeace was not my friend. He was insane, a reckless, arrogant madman. And I wouldn't get too optimistic, he went on dully. Nauda may have promised not to kill you, but that doesn't mean one of the others won't. I'm surprised they haven't spotted that. It's the kind of ambiguity they normally pounce on. Yes, they'll eat you soon enough. Take it from me. Icy fury surged through Kitty. She stepped forward and slapped Mandrake hard. He reeled back in shock, clutching his face.
What was that for? What for? Kitty shouted. For everything. For abducting me? For getting me into this mess? For being a member of the stupid government? For the war? For being a magician? For enslaving demons and spurring them to invade our world? For being a complete and utter idiot?
She took a breath. And for what you just said. For being defeatist now. Especially that. I don't intend to die. She halted, but kept him speared squarely on her gaze. He blinked, ran a hand through his stubbled hair, looked away, looked back at her. She stared at him. All right, he said. I'm sorry. Sorry for what I've done to you. For what I did before, and now. I should have left you alone. I regret I've got you into this. But what's the point of saying it? It's all irrelevant. The demons are loosed upon the world, and we're powerless to stop them. So whether you're here or back in that pub won't make much difference in the long run. Kitty shook her head. You're wrong. Your apology isn't irrelevant, and you're a fool if you can't see it. I'm grateful that you stopped Makepeace from having me killed. Now stop being such a wet blanket and try to think of something to do. He looked at her. Hold on. Was there a thanks buried in that pile of invective? She pursed her lips. If so, it was a very small one. Now, you're a magician, but you've not got any slaves to hand, not even any imps. No. All my slaves are dead, except Bartimaeus, and he left us. He saved our lives. Mandrake sighed. Yes. He looked at Kitty intently. And I don't think he did it for me. Why? His eyes widened suddenly. Hold on. I do have this. He fished in his jacket and produced a metal disc. You might recall it. Kitty's heart, having leapt with hope, descended leadenly. Oh, your scrying glass. Yes. The imp within can observe and speak to third parties, but it cannot act. It cannot free us or the other magicians. He broke off, thinking hard. Observation might be useful. Kitty couldn't hide her doubt. Providing you can trust what it says, it's a slave. Why should it speak truthfully after all its ill-treatment? Compared to most, I am a kind and sensitive master. I never... He made an impatient noise. Oh, this is ridiculous. Bickering will get us nowhere. Let's see what the demons are doing. He raised the disc and waved a hand across its surface. Kitty moved closer, fascinated despite herself. The polished bronze surface seemed to ripple. A round shape formed, hazy and remote, as if deep down under water. It swelled, drew close, became a sweet little baby's face, contorted into an expression of the purest woe.
"Not again, master," the baby whimpered. "I beg you, do not punish me again with the cruel stipples or the infernal coals. I will do my best, I swear." Oh, but I must accept your harsh justice, your stern discipline. What choice have I, alas?
It finished with a pathetic, lingering sniffle. Mandrake glanced furtively at Kitty. So, she said grimly, a kind and sensitive master.
Ah, no, he exaggerates. He excels in melodrama.
That poor, innocent little babe.
Do not be misled. He is a hellish, vile... Oh, what's the use? Imp! In a hall close to here, you will find several potent entities masquerading in the bodies of men and women. What are they doing? Observe and do not linger, or they will seize you and place you on a griddle. Next, and still within this building, locate the government magicians. Are they alive or dead?
What condition are they in? Could we communicate with them? Finally, observe the situation on the Whitehall streets. Are government forces anywhere to be seen? That is enough. Be off with you.
A plaintive cry. The disc went blank. Kitty shook her head sourly.
How can you claim any moral authority when you keep such a thing imprisoned? It's pure hypocrisy.
Mandrake scowled.
Never mind that now. You wanted me to act. I'm acting.
There was a new urgency about him. He paced the room. The demons are formidable, particularly Nauda. It is a married or stronger. Once it learns to control the body, its power will be terrible.
How can we oppose it? If the government were freed, we might summon enough djinn to destroy it. But the government is captive. So what remains?
He glanced at the scrying glass. All was still within it.
There is one possibility, he went on, but the odds against it are excessive. What? Gladstone's staff is in this building. It would be a match for Nauda, but it is magically guarded. I'd have to find a way to get to it, and evade Nauda first, Kitty said. And then there's the little question of whether I'd have the strength to use it. Yes, you didn't last time. All right, I know. I am stronger than then, but I'm also tired.
He took up the disc again.
Where is that imp? Probably dead in a ditch from ill treatment. Mandrake, Kitty said, do you know of the magician Ptolemaeus?
He frowned.
Of course, but how have you? And his apocrypha? You have heard of that?
Yes, yes, it is on my shelf.
So? What is Ptolemy's gate?
He regarded her blankly.
Ptolemy's gate? Kitty, that is a question for scholars and magicians, hardly for commoners. Why do you ask? Simple, she said. Because I can't read ancient Greek.
She put her hand in her tattered coat and drew out Mr. Button's book.
If I could, I'd have found out for myself. You, I assume, with all your privileges, can and have. What is this gate? How does one get to the other place? And stop asking me questions, we haven't time.
Mandrake reached out and took the small, slim volume, slightly scorched where the inferno had struck. Handing her the blank bronze disc, he opened the book with gentle fingers and flipped the pages slowly at random, eyes scanning the columns. He shrugged.
A work of fiction. Charmingly idealistic in some of its conceits, if not wrong-headed. Some of its statements. Well, Ptolemy's gate is a supposed method of reversing the normal summoning process, whereby the magician, or some element, spirit, or sentience thereof, withdraws for a time to the particular remoteness where demons reside. The author, by reputation this was the Alexandrine Ptolemaeus, claims to have done it himself, though why he should risk such a terrifying ordeal is far from clear. Good enough for you? Oh, sorry, that's a question. No, it's not good enough. What's the exact formula? Does he give it?
Mandrake clapped his head in irritation.
Kitty, have you gone quite mad? We have more important things to... Just tell me!
She started toward him, fists clenched. Mandrake veered back. As he did so, the scrying glass throbbed and hummed in Kitty's hands. The baby's face returned, looking frightened and out of breath. For a few seconds it did not speak, but only wheezed and puffed immoderately. Kitty shook her head in pity. Your slave's back. He's practically dead, poor little mite. The baby belched loudly, then spoke in a hoarse whisper.
Who's this trollop?
With pointed gallantry, Mandrake took the disc from her hands.
Just tell us what you saw. It wasn't a pretty sight, boss.
The baby picked its nose with an agitated finger.
Am I right in thinking this will be the last job you give me? On account of the fact that you're locked in a cell and surrounded by rampant demons preparing to take the vengeance that they prayed for thousands of years? Just wondering.
Kitty ground her teeth with impatience. Mandrake glanced at her.
What do you think? The infernal coals? Anything.
The baby gave an anxious croak and spoke at speed.
I followed your orders to the letter. You can have no complaint. First, the great spirits. Ah, they are powerful. The planes warp with their passing. There are seven, all wear actual human bodies concealing their true forms. At their centre sits Nauda. He issues rapid commands. The others scatter to do his bidding. In neighbouring chambers, the corpses of Whitehall bureaucrats lie like skittles.
from a side room.
Mandrake interrupted the desperate flow.
Wait, how do the demons move? Are they comfortable in their hosts? For the most part, no. They move as if with broken limbs, but yet they sing with the joy of freedom. Would that I could join them, the baby said wistfully. I would set your boat.